I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Jack Leffler. He is an author, an oral historian, and a radio producer, and he has put together a set of panel discussions that start on February 13th. They're going to be monthly, February, March, April, May, and June. And the theme is Water Crisis in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
So this is a set of panel discussions that really looks at water from a bunch of different perspectives here in the Southwest. How did this all come together?
Well, in the first place, apparently the Chemo Theater, which is where this is all being held, came up with a notion, some of the folks down there came up with a notion that indeed water is a huge factor that it really needs to be addressed seriously. And so they approached Craig Newbill, who's the director of the New Mexico Humanities Council, to see if some sort of a situation like this could come into being. And Craig, who's an old friend, and we've worked together for many, many years, asked me if I'd perhaps give out some ideas based on my last book, or our last book, Thinking Like a Watershed. And so I came up with some notions and everything to include in the proposal that they submitted. And indeed, the project was funded by the New Mexico Humanities Council and in coherence, so to speak, with the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. And indeed, we're doing these five panels. And so the idea, the basic concept, was to try to create a sphere of reference or a much bigger picture to look at rather than just following the reductionist lines that we normally think within. And as that concept expanded, so did the panels. And so we have these five panels coming up with the hope of producing four more to fulfill the whole bigger picture coming up next autumn. And so that's the idea.
Now, the first one is on February 13th, and as we said, at the Chemo Theater in Albuquerque. And when we have an overview of the five panels that you have so far, not to mention the four that we hope will be coming next fall, what you've got is basically looking at water from really different and yet interrelated perspectives. And I think just the structure of this set of events underlines the fact that there are so many different ways of looking at and thinking about water. And if you just do one of them, if you just think like an engineer or think like an ecosystem scientist or think like a municipal planner, you're not going to get the big picture and you're not going to solve the problem.
Absolutely. And it may be one of those unsolvable problems, but part of it is learning how to adapt to shifting circumstances. That's a huge concept right now that has to be factored right throughout all of this. But in order to really create the bigger picture, I've talked to many, many friends, many of whom you know and have had on your radio show, people like Bill DeBuise, who is going to be on the first panel. His book, A Great Aridness, gives a very good idea of what we can, the fact that we will have many changes in the nature of our climate and precipitation and all of those things coming down in the very, well, happening right now, actually. And he did his homework big time on that book. It's a fantastic book. It's a fantastic read. And he has a wonderful mind, really all-inclusive mind that's very fluid and facile. And subsequently, he can let his mind wander throughout these various issues, many of which don't apparently at the outset seem to be related to water at all, but they all are. It's all the bigger picture of what an ecosystem, or in this case, a watershed, looks like. We also have for that first panel one of America's great historians, Patty Limerick, from the Center for the American West up in Boulder, Colorado. Her book, The Legacy of Conquest, is really a fascinating book that actually looks into many of the things that happened back in the 19th century, early 20th century, with regard to how culture moving into the arid West from the verdant East affected the way we went into the West, resulting in things like Manifest Destiny, which really took an enormous toll on all the indigenous peoples who were already here and knew how to comport themselves within the context of their home ecosystems. That's a big one.
Now, you said from the verdant east to the arid west, and when you think about conquest, you don't necessarily think about climate exactly, and yet that plays a big role.
It does. One of the things that Patty pointed out in a radio series that I produced many years ago, 12 years ago, entitled Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, she pointed out that people who were coming from the East were fitting within that sort of gospel-based mentality, cultural mentality, that they looked at the arid West as God's mistake, and that their charge given to them by God was to restore this mistake into something that really worked so that it could all look like Ohio. That's Patty. She has the most droll sense of humor. And but at any rate, that's true. And what's interesting to me is that by near the end of the 19th century, in 1988, 89, 90, our great geographer, scientist, adventurer John Wesley Powell came out here. And actually, in order to try to convince people back east the nature of the arid West, created this fabulous map showing the watersheds of the West. And he was vigorously trying to get the Congress of the United States to organize the West politically by watersheds rather than by this strange geopolitical hodgepodge that we currently have.
Which is made up of a lot of straight lines.
Yes, made up of a lot of straight lines and also entrepreneurial fantasies. And
What do you mean by that?
well, basically, he was shot down by entrepreneurs, developers back east at that time who are really vigorously lobbying Congress to let the West be seen as a place to pillage, basically, for natural resources to make lots of money. And so the whole concept of turning habitat into money really began to flourish right about then.
Now, it's interesting that things like trying to grow verdant crops and ranch and so on in the arid West has its roots in some kind of theology, like this whole concept of God's mistake. These are things that none of us would ever know. I mean, the idea, we just think that people came out and they wanted, the entrepreneurial explanation. They wanted to exploit resources, but not that it has somehow has to do with restoring land to some kind of concept of what God is that anyway?
Well, that's the God of the verdant East. But the upshot is that they were probably hearkening back to early concepts of Eden, the Edenic phase, so to speak, of Western culture. But what happens in the West is that we really have, when you think about it, the Intermountain West, which extends between the Rocky Mountains on the eastern aspect of it to the Cascade Sierra Mountains on the west. There are only three major river systems that empty into any sea: the Columbia River system, which is enormous, which empties into the Pacific Ocean up between Washington, what is now Washington and Oregon; the Rio Colorado watershed, which drains all the way, or used to, down to the Sea of Cortez. Now it's so overtapped that almost nothing gets to the Sea of Cortez; and then the Rio Grande, our home watershed right here, which ostensibly drains down into the Gulf of Mexico. And so what we're looking at are these huge watersheds. The Rio Grande, by the way, is such a minuscule stream relative to the Columbia River and even to the Colorado River. 2 weeks ago, I was back in Kentucky looking at the Ohio River, and I'll bet you 200, 300 Rio Grandes would fit into that river.
Really?
So that's the difference in perspective between people back there and people out here.
Even the Rio Grande in its prime?
Even in its prime, the thing that's happening is that over the years, over this, well, over better than a century now, we've been actually able to measure the rate of flow down both the Colorado River and the Rio Grande. And back at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a fair amount more water than there is now, because that was a particularly rainy period, high precipitation back in those days, which it no longer prevails. As a matter of fact, as we can see from looking at the news, California is in such dire straits that some communities only have 20 or so days of drinking water left. And so we're looking at that sort of a situation. And so basically, these panels are trying to look at the way it was, the way it is, and not really trying to predict a future, but at least set up a system of parameters through which we might be able to extrapolate certain possibilities, even some probabilities, so that we can prepare ourselves to begin to contend. In other words, we have to become very adaptable, resilient. Now, those two words are becoming big words in today's vocabulary, and they're becoming part of the vernacular of climate change and global warming.
Well, it scares me a little bit, I have to say, when we talk about adapting to climate change instead of talking about radically reducing the burning of fossil fuels, because there's some adaptation you can do, but this is so much bigger than what we can adapt to and keep any semblance of our current natural world and probably civilization.
One of my biggest worries is that the two big reservoirs on the Colorado River, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, are going down, down, down. Now, they're held in check by two great dams, the Hoover Dam, formerly known as the Boulder Dam, but the Hoover Dam, so named after Herbert Hoover, who presided over the 1922 Colorado River Compact that resulted in that dam. And also, Lake Powell is hemmed in by Glen Canyon Dam. Now, those two lakes, at their peak, would hold something like 28 million acre-feet and 24 million acre-feet, respectively. The lakes have gone down so far that one could anticipate in the not-too-distant future them going down just another 20 or 30 feet apiece, thus rendering the hydroelectric capacity of those dams to cease, which then results in that electricity no longer being there. And subsequently, because of our extraordinary power needs that we're already relying on, what does this mean? This means that will people start looking at the coal reserves in the American West and anticipating the construction of more coal-fired power plants, thus resulting in more CO2 in the atmosphere, thus creating even a more formidable form of climate change and global warming more imminently? It's this kind of series of questions that we have to look at so seriously now.
And even more aridness in the West, which basically, I mean, this is what's called a positive feedback loop, but don't think the word positive means good.
No, not in this case. One of the things that Powell recognized way back when was that each watershed, which he so clearly defines on his wonderful map, is a self-contained unit. Now, one of the panelists that we'll have, actually in panel four, a wonderful thinker named M. Hall, who has at least two wonderful books out, both of which I've got. One is entitled High and Dry, which focuses on the Rio Pecos, and the other is Reining in the Rio Grande, R-E-I-N. Reining in,
okay.
Yes. And basically, what M pointed out to me at one point, not that long ago, is that by virtue of the San Juan Chama diversion, which we have grown to rely upon, what that means is taking 110,000 acre-feet a year out of the Colorado River watershed, actually out of the San Juan River watershed, the San Juan being a tributary of the Colorado, and pumping it through a tunnel 23 miles long beneath the Continental Divide into the Rio Grande watershed up at Heron Lake that empties into the Chama, and thence the Chama empties into the Rio Grande. Now, we have at this point come to rely on that 110,000 acre-feet a year. But as we look at the newspapers and listen to the news and everything about what's happening in California, and realizing that a huge percentage, half of the water that goes down the Colorado River, is designated to go to cities like Los Angeles, San Diego, Phoenix, and Tucson, basically what happens is that watershed is decreasing at such an extent that it's obvious that soon the Colorado River watershed will be unable to fulfill its promise of the 110,000 acre feet a year in the San Juan Chama diversion for us. But in the meantime, have we indeed, as a human population, outgrown the carrying capacity of the existing Rio Grande watershed? If we haven't yet, we will if we don't watch our step. And that's what I'm one of the many factors that we're trying to put into this. Each system is its own watershed. And when you create interbasin transfers of water, you're actually producing unnatural acts.
We're talking to author and oral historian Jack Leffler about the upcoming series of panel discussions, Water Crisis in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed. So what happens when the carrying capacity, let's say, of a watershed or of an ecosystem is exceeded?
Well, in that case, its population must decrease one way or the other, either by its own intelligently rendered volition or through catastrophe. That's basically the bottom line. And there are no answers, really, to any of these heavy-duty issues. It's basically responding in an adaptable fashion, in a resilient fashion, to the inspiration of the moment as these crises appear. For example, right now I know that a rancher friend up in near Cimarron, who's been there, that ranch has been in business for over a century, and she's one of many several generations of ranchers right on that ranch. The last two or three years, the water that's coming out of the aquifer is too saline to fulfill the thirst of the cattle. Subsequently, they're having to truck water from the Cimarron River. But one of the problems, and she conveys that this problem is actually, you can see this because the snowmelt, the snowpack in the eastern aspect of the Southern Rockies has just been so lightweight of recent years that the aquifer itself is not being recharged. Okay, the same thing could be said of the Ogallala aquifer. That was one of the biggest aquifers in the world, but it is no longer fed at nearly the rate at which it's being pumped out. And so, obviously, the only way that the remaining waters can remain in any sort of tact at all is if we quit pumping at the rates that we're pumping, which means a tremendous shift in lifestyle. Now, what is interesting to me, and I know this is hard, but these are rural communities that have created a culture of practice that is commensurate with their perceptions as how to live in that particular land. In other words, that country that's east of us, out in the Great Plains, which used to be a real prairie of Great Plains, has now been usurped in large measure of its aquifers in order to feed the needs, the perceived needs of the cattle that they're being grown, the people who live there, to say nothing of the urban areas which are occurring in other areas throughout, say, New Mexico. We look at New Mexico, which has a population of just over 2 million, and I learned just the other day that over the last 2 years, the population has very tinily diminished rather than increased, which is interesting news and good news to me. Half of our population, or very close to half of our population, lives in the region of Albuquerque. Now, at the beginning of the 20th century, the powers that be in political places like Washington, D.C., determined that the best use of water as perceived through the cultural eyes of that period of just over 100 years ago was agriculture. So the sense of agriculture as best use is what's come to prevail. However, and that's when the population of New Mexico was just a tiny fraction of what it is today. In the subsequent century, what's happened is that the human population has grown enormously, basically in urban areas, places like Albuquerque, Las Cruces, the Farmington region, even Santa Fe, to the extent that you can anticipate huge sense of competition between the urban areas and the rural areas over this water. And the concept of best use will probably shift, or may possibly shift, from agriculture to urban and industrial.
But there is something that I think is very important to be said to that, which is that in New Mexico, and indeed everywhere in the world, basically, what it boils down to is municipal areas, residential cities, place like Santa Fe, place like Albuquerque, will use approximately 10% of the total water. Agriculture uses between 80 and 90%. And so that competition, it makes me wonder, how real is that competition? I mean, we have what was a growing population. Now you're saying it's a very slightly diminishing population. But the most bang for our buck in terms of saving water is absolutely in agriculture.
Absolutely. No, I'm not denying that by one iota. What I am saying is that we have to realize that we're having ever less water. And so how do we adapt our cultural perspectives to this whole scenario? Now, to me, the biggest problem we face, believe it or not, in my own mind, is not even global warming and climate instability. It's actually cultural attitude. Our overall cultural attitude has really been locked into place and dominated by an economic imperative that is an erroneous concept in the long run. And so our big thing is to shift our attitude to be more commensurate with the nature of the flow of nature. And how do we perceive ourselves in a situation where water is becoming less abundant, radically less abundant, over the long haul? Now, I recently interviewed a guy who's a fine thinker and a fine writer who really doesn't look to the future so much as he looks to really working well within the right now. But to me, it's absolutely vital that we try to get the bigger picture of all of the factors that we can possibly imagine and hold in mind or on the blackboard or in books and articles and everything else in order to be able to successfully extrapolate future possibilities. Because without the ability to extrapolate future possibilities, our heritage is going to go right down the drain along with the rest of the water.
We're talking to author, oral historian, and radio producer Jack Leffler, talking about the upcoming series of panel discussions, Water Crisis in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed. Now, before the break, you were saying that there is a real issue of not only the economic system, but cultural attitudes. And I was wondering, where do you go to modify or expand or change or rethink your cultural attitudes? This is part of what you're doing in these discussions.
Well, that's a very good issue to address, Mary Charlotte, and one that I think is right at the heart of the problem. As we look back to the 19th century and the way Eastern American culture had moved into the West, and we had seen the results of Manifest Destiny, we're still seeing that here, where we actually took over, we conquered indigenous cultures, cultures that had been able to sustain themselves for millennia, maybe, here in the American arid West. Now, those people still have remnants of the systems of attitudes that were necessary. They have a whole cultural perspective. I refer to it as indigenous mind. It's not trying to lump all of the indigenous cultures together under one headset, because that's not the way it is at all. The Navajos differ from the Puebloans, differ from the Tohono O'odham, etc., etc. But they all have one thing in common. The traditional peoples of all of the landscapes, wherever I've been, from Idaho to Chiapas, all of the traditional people and in indigenous cultures have regarded the land as sacred. One of the things that seems to have come along with Eastern American culture moving into the West is the secularization of habitat. And so one of the things that I think that we really need to factor into this is a much wider perspective. Cultural diversity is as important as biodiversity, because the human species, being the keystone species right now on this planet, is also the most conscious species, at least as far as we know, and thus the most capable of adapting to each different habitat. But if we're adapting to a habitat in order to turn that habitat into money, in order to satisfy our materialistic consumerism, we are on the wrong trail. And this is something that we can take a cue from the indigenous cultures that have existed here for a long time. And I'm including Hispano culture there, because those people who came 400 years ago were gradually rooted to this landscape. One of the things that I think is that so many of us in this peripatetic culture that is global culture have pulled up any sense of rootedness to habitat. And it's until we re-root ourselves within some sort of a sense of homeland and listen to that homeland carefully and really come to understand the attributes of that, then and only then will we be able to contend with the nature of what's coming down the pike. Well, I did want to mention that back in the early 1970s, the concept of bioregionalism began to evolve as a major notion that addresses this very issue very clearly, in that we not only learn the reductionist approach to the flow of nature, in other words, we don't look at just the nature of the species and all of that kind of stuff, we really come to understand the relationship of the human psyche, both individually and culturally, to a respective habitat. And that's what the native peoples have to teach us and to help us restore that window of perspective that we have glossed over, that we've blind shaded ourselves to.
When you talk about learning from indigenous people, I mean, whether it be our local Puebloan or Hispano, or, I mean, as you say, down to Chiapas, you're talking about subsistence cultures. And we don't live in a subsistence culture. We live in a culture which is city-based, which is the root of the word civilized, and we have way more comforts and privileges and abilities to travel and do all kinds of things that you don't have in subsistence cultures. Are you talking about giving that stuff up?
What I'm talking about is trying to reestablish a cultural perspective of seeing ourselves relative to our habitat, which would thereafter lead us into a more sustainable situation with regard to where we actually live. In other words, if indeed we run out of water in New Mexico, we won't be able to stay here. People cannot survive without water. If we are not capable, at least on some level, of having a form of agriculture that is sustaining us as a human population, we're also going to be in dire straits. Because if one looks at this crisis the way I'm looking at it, well, for example, I recently interviewed a man by the name of Jerry Mander, who had written this wonderful book, The Capitalist Papers, Fatal Flaws in an Erroneous System. And Jerry is very strongly of the opinion that within the next human generation, our economic system will probably fail. Now, that's a big thought. And one of the things that he sees, is, and others like Bill DeBuise sees, is a possible way around that, is to culturally attempt to re-achieve a steady state economics, which is what the indigenous cultures had. Now, what I'm not suggesting is that we try to return to that state, but that we understand that those people had a perspective that we could well adapt into our own culture, adapt ourselves to within our own culture, of seeing ourselves relative to habitat rather than separate from it. And I think that that's part of the key to success. That's kind of a complicated and subtle concept, but the way we're going right now with our consumerism and our materialism and our total domination by the capitalist system, which itself is not evil. What it is, it's basically focused on making money for its own sake. Therefore, that's its principle. But we can't apply that to the planet. We cannot have a growing human population working forevermore within a system of extraction of finite natural resources. And one of the things that I always try to point out in my lectures is that in my 77 years on this planet, the human population of the planet has more than tripled.
That's crazy.
It sure is.
Now, when Jerry Mander in The Capitalist Papers talks about how in his view, this economic system is going to fail within the next generation. What is that failure based on?
Well, it's based on the fact that we have the finite capacity for extraction of resources.
So it's basically an ecological collapse. Because,
it is. Yeah. It really is. That's precisely what it is.
Yeah. Which, I mean, this is the point that I think we have to just keep on talking about over and over and over, is that all economics are based on land. They're based on extraction. They're based on farming. They're based on what we take out of the earth and off of the earth and out of the water. And you can't do that in a kind of purely exploitive way and expect it to last forever.
No, and one of the things I would like to point out is that this landscape and waterscape of our planet Earth is really a commons. It's commons. It's something for each species to be able to withdraw from and to put back to in order to keep the commons going. In other words, it's as though it's a life process. I had a recent conversation with a really brilliant guy over in Kansas named Wes Jackson, who actually looks at the planet as a supra-organism, which is sort of hearkening to James Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis, but right. It's sort of different in a way. But the upshot is that we, as a species on this planet, one of billions of species on this planet, are just that, part of a living organism, actually, unto its own. And it's that sense of the commons from which we all take and we all give back that keeps the whole thing going and well-sustained. However, in the last two centuries, well, basically since the Industrial Revolution, according to Wendell Berry, whom I recently had a great conversation with, and Wendell contends that it was with the coming of the Industrial Revolution that we really developed a system of attitudes that's totally non-commensurate with our relationship to the planet itself. And one of the things I want to bring out is that not only do we over-extract from this planet of ours, but we've created a whole system of legislation that is fostering this over-extraction and is actually, in many ways, our system of laws violates the laws of nature. And so we have to look at that very carefully. And how do we react to that?
And how do you get people to really understand that?
Well, the privatization of the commons is, to me, something that everybody could possibly understand. For example, people over in Texas right now are trying to privatize certain waters that exist within the Oglala Aquifer to pump that water to Texas and basically deprive the aquifer of its water, which is sustaining what used to be the Great Plains, which has now been farmed to the extent that in the 1930s, the Dust Bowl happened, because obviously the farming of the Great Plains was a mistake. The keystone species had been wiped out by virtue of an order from General Sherman back in the 19th century, that being bison, and the farmers moved in and began to grow annual crops of wheat and corn, and when drought hits, as it inevitably does, the topsoil ended up over in New Mexico. Now, with the coming of the pumping of the Oglala Aquifer, all of a sudden, the water was coming back up to the surface of the planet, and the dust was no longer blowing into New Mexico, so to speak. However, that aquifer has all been pulled out. The water is almost gone, maybe 20 years left of being able to pump. And what that means is then we can anticipate even a bigger dust bowl. So it's the exploitation, it's the privatizing of these common waters that are part of the flow of nature as we understand it. The bottom line is that there are just too many of us on this planet, and we're going to have to gradually, if we do it intelligently, we're going to have to gradually reduce our human population. We're going to have to confront some of the existing mores that are embedded in our culture. In other words, we have to look at the fact that we cannot afford to have a whole bunch of kids per family. I mean, when you think about a single lifetime and the whole human population tripling in that lifetime. That's a huge thought. And indeed, it's anticipated, should we continue in the current trend, that by 2050, which is what? It's only 36 years away, that the population could be as high as 10 billion people. We're fostering catastrophe on a large scale. So what I'm trying to come up with is, how do we begin to look at this in some sort of a realistic way? And part of what these panels is to do, for example, one panel 4 is oriented to looking at the evolution of water law in the American Southwest so that we can see where it works and where it is absolute, it is an absolute discrepancy within the context of the flow of nature. What I'm trying to do is foster the notion that within each of our watersheds, we begin to become more self-governing rather than constantly relying on governance from on high, because governance from on high is not in touch with the landscape.
We're talking to Jack Leffler. If you talk about putting control back on a local level, how do you know that the local folks aren't going to say, let's pump every last drop out of the Oglala Reservoir or whatever?
Well, that's a very good question. Now, part of the way you look at that is you say, okay, there's 20 years of pumping water out of the Oglala Aquifer at its current rate before there isn't going to be anything that's pumpable. In the meantime, the babies that you're having right now are going to be 20 years old trying to live on this landscape. How do you think about that? You're thinking in terms of future generations. That, by the way, is one of the things that at least it's part of the mythology of the indigenous mind, is thinking seven generations hence. And one of the things that's of great interest to me is that it's just about seven generations now since Anglo ranchers have moved into this neck of the woods. And they are really contending with how their forebears overgrazed the landscape because they were thinking in terms of Ohio and the verdant East. And people like Sid Goodlow, who's going to be in panel number 3, talking about the rural perspective. Those are the kind of people who have the wisdom to try to communicate to their peers as to how do we affect the landscape. Stan Crawford is also going to be on that panel, as is Steve Harris, who's a fantastic thinker and knows a lot about water in the West. And so that's, to me, one of the answers. And it's also not total decentralization of governing power. Eleanor Ostrom, the winner of the 2009 Nobel Prize for Economics, wrote a phenomenal book called Governing the Commons. And she and her husband devised a theory which they called polycentric governance, which has a state of reciprocal governance that extends from both the grassroots from below and Washington hierarchy from on high, but in a state of reciprocity throughout the entire practice of governance, and really relying largely on the rural perspective, the indigenous perspective, because that's the one that knows the nature of that habitat.
How do you respond when people say, well, we can desalinate water and we can do it ever more inexpensively and we can build pipelines from the ocean toward inland regions and just solve the water problem?
Well, that's an interesting issue right there. And so I don't know too much about it. However, I will say this. I visited the desalination plant down in Yuma, Arizona, when I was doing the radio series on the Colorado River. And the reason that plant is there is because as farmers have they've put water into their fields, and as the water returns to the watershed, it comes back more saline than when it went into the watershed. And we have a treaty with Mexico to deliver 1.5 million acre-feet a year of water that is usable for irrigation. And it mustn't be too saline. And so that's why that plant was built. Now, it's only been put, even though it's been on the line for decades at this point, it's only recently that it's being used. And I'm made to understand that even in cities like Los Angeles and San Diego especially, they're really beginning to now plan on creating desalination plants in order to use the Pacific Ocean for fresh water. That has problems of its own. First of all, a plant has to be an enormous plant to really make a dent in the water needs of any given urban situation like LA or San Diego. Secondly, where do you put the salt? There are these kinds of thoughts. You have to extrapolate the problems that are going to come down the pike rather than just do it and then contend with the problems thereafter.
Which is what we've been doing since the 19th century in this whole span of time that you've been talking about. Nobody came in and said, we want to ruin the land. Everybody went in thinking that they were making life better.
Exactly. And it's not as though the idea and the whole motivation behind it were dead wrong. Actually, that's what people do. They try to make things better. We all do. Even the pack rats out where I live, out in the boonies, love to build nests made out of cholla in the wood pile, so that when I go get a log to throw into the fireplace, I always or frequently get a handful of cholla. But every creature is trying to make itself better, fit within the context of it. And that's not the issue so much as how we do it. Now, what I love is the idea of being able to extrapolate. That's what comes with consciousness. To me, the great gift of life is consciousness in our species. We have a fantastic handle on consciousness, but we've really used it in kind of a paltry way in many ways. It's if we used it in some kind of elevated fashion wherein we were looking at the fact that we are this tiny dot in space that has life on it, and some of that life has consciousness in it. We're actually a conscious entity floating through space. And if we use it in a suicidal way, that little blue dot is going to turn brown. And that's a big thought to me right there. So one of the things that I'm working on right now, and I guess this is really the heart of my own work, the new radio series, the new book, and all of that stuff, is looking at consciousness itself as a commons. And it's that commons of consciousness that we have to be so careful with what we take out of it, and so careful with what we put into it. That, to me, is the critical factor right now.
I think about that quite often when I read the media on the internet, because first of all, that is a place, you know, the internet in a really big way is a kind of commons. Virtually anybody can tap into it. Virtually anybody can put in, we can all take out, we can watch things, we can amuse each other, we can learn. And the amount of good thoughts that are there is significant, and also the amount of kind of vitriol and rage and basically putting in really unhelpful ideas into this commons is worrisome to me, and I don't know what's to be done about it, but it's such a great opportunity that in some ways is being squandered.
It sure is, and it is a great opportunity, and it is in large measure being squandered. But one of the things that I feel, well, my great fortune cookie about enthusiasm, being able to tame beasts and charm brutes, always resides at the forefront of my frontal lobes.
Fortune cookie?
Yeah. It was a great fortune cookie.
For real?
Yeah.
You got a fortune cookie about enthusiasm?
I did. It said, enthusiasm tames beasts, it charms brutes.
Nice.
And I thought that that was one of the great things one could get out of one's fortune cookie, but I'm basically an optimist. I can't help myself, even though I look at the evidence. I think that if we really use this incredible new way of understanding consciousness as a commons through just what you're saying, the internet and all of that stuff, one of the things that we have to do, and some people would chide me for saying have to do, but I believe it, is to approach things like the internet in a state of understanding that we are functioning reciprocally with other people who are also using the internet to express their thoughts and their commons of consciousness. And we understand, one of my great heroes was the philosopher Peter Kropotkin, who was basically an anarchist philosopher who was also a geographer and a great thinker, and armed with Darwin, went into the mountains of Siberia and watched wildlife happening. And he wrote his magnum opus entitled Mutual Aid, and on page 300 of that, and I'm slightly paraphrasing here, Kropotkin said, evolution of species / human culture owes far more to mutual cooperation than mutual antagonism. And if we can keep forwarding that into this internet level of commons, but also in the interactions between humans and humans, and humans and other species. In other words, in a way, I think this wonderful commons of the internet is also yet one more filter we put between ourselves and seeing the flow of nature for what it really is.
We're talking to Jack Leffler about the upcoming panel discussion, Water Crisis in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed. Now, this is Thursday nights at 7 o'clock, starting on the 13th of February at the Chemo Theater in Albuquerque. And on the 13th, you're going to be doing a historical overview of the water situation in the West, as you mentioned before, with Bill Dubuis, Patty Limerick, and author John Nichols. And then on March 27th, you go on to Indigenous Perspective, Native Americans, featuring Rena Swensel, Lyle Belenqua, and Esteban Arellano. Then on April 24th, Rural Perspectives, Farmers and Ranchers with Sid Goodlow, Stan Crawford, and Steve Harris. May 29th, Water Law in the West. And June 26th, the whole question of privatizing our water resources. And as if that weren't enough, you want to do four more next fall.
Yes, I do. And I want to use next fall, if we're lucky enough to get the funding to put this all together, to flush out even bigger, more aspects of the bigger picture. And I want to bring in some of the younger people who are really the inheritors of all of this. And I want to bring in people like Gerrymander, who wrote that wonderful book I mentioned earlier, and people like Wes Jackson, and other folks who really have been thinking about this for decades, to come up with real alternatives that we can do right here in our own homeland in order to be able to try to ensure some sense of survivability here.
We'll also be, with any luck, making really good quality recordings of all these evenings and broadcasting them here on the Radio Cafe. And then you're also going to be doing a radio series in the future.
Yes, indeed. And I'm assured by the folks at the Chemo Theater that the recordings are going to be broadcast worthy, and then you and I will put them together for Radio Cafe. And
yay.
I thank you so much for that, Mary Charlotte.
Well, it's a great pleasure. It's really important. I mean, this is worth, if you're in Santa Fe, driving down to Albuquerque to go to each one of these events at the Chemo Theater. And if you're in Albuquerque, it's right there. I mean, the bottom line is that even though you and I are not involved in water policy making, it is our responsibility to understand this and talk about it and think about it and kind of get that consciousness into the commons in a broader and more thoughtful manner than maybe we've had in the past.
Absolutely. And what you've just said harkens to absolutely every one of us, that we have to individually and collectively accept the responsibility for our presence here on the planet and really act accordingly.
Jack Leffler is an author, oral historian, and radio producer. The series of panel discussions, Water Crisis in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed, begins on Thursday, February 13th. It's at 7 o'clock at the Chemo Theater in Albuquerque, and it is free and open to the public. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. This is a true pleasure, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.